sick. Something was killing these cells. They were swollen and puffy, fat-looking, as if they were pregnant. Tom could see that they contained granules or specks. The specks looked like pepper, as if someone had shaken pepper over fried eggs. He may have seen reflections of light in the pepper, as if light was gleaming through crystals. Crystals? These cells were unrecognizably sick, and they were very sick, because the fluid was milky and clouded with dead cells, cells that had exploded. They decided that their boss, Peter Yarling, should have a look. Geispert went to find Yarling. He exited Level 3, removed his scrub suit and took a water shower and dressed in civilian clothes and went to Yarling's office. Then he and Yarling returned to the Level 3 lab. It took a few minutes for both of them to change in the locker room and put on scrub suits. When they were ready to go in, dressed like surgeons, they entered and sat down at the eyepieces of the microscope. Geispert said to him, "There's something very strange going on in that flask, but I'm not sure what it is. This isn't like SHF." Yarling looked. He saw that the flask had turned milky, as if it had gone rotten. "This is contaminated," he said. "These cells are blown away. They're crud." The cells were exploded and dead. "They're off the plastic," he remarked. By off the plastic, he meant that the dead cells had detached from the surface of the flask and had floated away in the broth. He thought that a wild strain of bacteria had invaded the cell culture. This is an annoying and common occurrence when you are trying to grow a virus and it wipes out the flask. The wild bacteria consume the cell culture, eat it up, and make a variety of different smells in the air while they're growing, whereas viruses kill cells without releasing an odor. Yarling guessed that the flask had been wiped out by a common soil bacterium called Pseudomonas. It lives in dirt. It lives in everyone's backyard and under fingernails. It is one of the most common forms of life on the planet, and it often gets into cell cultures and wrecks them. Yarling unscrewed the little black cap and waved his hand over the flask to bring the scent to his nose, and then he took a whiff. Funny. No smell. He said to Tom Geispert, "Have you ever smelled Pseudomonas?" "No," Tom replied. "It smells like Welch's grape juice. Here." He offered the flask to Tom. Tom sniffed it. There was no smell. Yarling took back the flask and whiffed it again. His nose registered nothing, but the flask was milky and the cells were blown away. He was puzzled. He handed the flask back to Tom and said, "Put it in the beam and let's look at it." By "put it in the beam," he meant look at it using the electron microscope, which is much more powerful than a light microscope and can see deeper into the universe within. Geispert poured some of the milky fluid out of the flask into a test tube and then spun it in a centrifuge machine. A button of grayish ooze collected at the bottom of the test tube, a tiny pill of dead and dying cells. The pill was the size of a pinhead, and it had a pale brownish color. Geispert thought it looked like a dab of mashed potato. He lifted out the button with a wooden stick and soaked the button in plastic resin to preserve it. But now, what was on his mind was the hunting season. Later that afternoon, Friday, he went home to get packed. He'd been planning to drive his Ford Bronco, but it had broken down. So one of his hunting buddies met him in a pickup truck, and they loaded Geispert's duffel bag and gun case into it and set off on his hunting trip. When a filovirus begins to amplify itself in a human being, the incubation period is from 3 to 18 days, while the number of virus particles climbs steadily in the bloodstream. Then comes the headache. Thanksgiving. November 20th to 25th. For Nancy and Jerry Jacks, it was the worst Thanksgiving of their lives. On Wednesday, November 22nd, they put their children in the family van and drove straight through the night to Kansas. Jamie was now 12 and Jason was 13. They were used to long drives to Kansas, and they slept peacefully. Jerry had almost lost his ability to sleep since the murder of his brother, and Nancy stayed awake with him, trading places behind the steering wheel. They arrived in Wichita on Thanksgiving Day and ate a meal of turkey with Nancy's father, Curtis Dunn, who was living with Nancy's brother. Nancy's father was dying of cancer. He had gone through life fearing that he might come down with cancer. He once took to his bed for 8 months while claiming he had cancer when in fact he did not. And now he had come down with real cancer. He had lost a lot of weight that fall. He was like a human skeleton, down to less than 100 pounds, but he was still a relatively young man, and his hair was black and curly and oiled with Vitalis. He looked so terrible that the children were afraid of him. He did his best to show sympathy for Jerry. "How awful it was, what happened to you Jackses," he said to Jerry. Jerry didn't want to talk about it. Nancy's father sat and slept in a reclining chair most of the day. At night, he couldn't sleep on account of the pain, and he would wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning and get out of bed and rummage around the house looking for something. He smoked cigarettes continually and complained that he couldn't taste his food, that he had lost his appetite. Nancy felt sorry for him, but she felt a distance from him that she couldn't overcome. He was a man of strong opinions, and lately, from the way he had been talking while he wandered about the house at night, it seemed that he was going to try to sell the family farm in Kansas and use the money to get himself to Mexico for a cure involving peach pits. Nancy was angry with him for having such ideas, and that anger was mixed with pity for him in his illness. After they had finished their turkey with Nancy's father, they drove out to Andale, Kansas, a town northwest of Wichita, and ate another dinner with Jerry's mother, Ada, and the rest of the Jacks family in Ada's house on the edge of town near the grain elevator. Ada was a widow who lived alone in a ranch house that looked out across beautiful wheat fields. The fields were bare and planted with winter wheat, and Ada sat in her chair in the living room and stared outdoors. She couldn't watch television because she was afraid she would see a gun. They sat around the living room and talked, telling stories about the old days on Ada's farm, laughing and joking and trying to have a good time, and suddenly John's name would come up. The conversation would flag into silence, and everyone would look at the floor, not knowing what to say, and someone would start crying, and then they would see tears running down Ada's face. She had always been a strong woman, and none of her children had ever seen her cry. When she felt she couldn't stop it, she would get up and leave the room and go into her bedroom and close the door. They set up tables in the kitchen and served roast beef. The Jackses didn't like turkey. After a while, people drifted into the living room with plates in their hands and watched a football game. The women, including Nancy, cleaned up around the kitchen and helped with the children. Afterward, Nancy and Jerry stayed on in Wichita for a few days to help Nancy's father get to the hospital for his cancer treatments. Then they drove back to Maryland in the van with their children. Dan Dalgard spent an uneasy Thanksgiving week. On Monday, he called Peter Yarling at the Institute to find out if Yarling had any further news about what had been killing the monkeys at Reston. Yarling now had a tentative diagnosis. It looked like they really did have SHF. Bad for monkeys, no problem for humans. He said to Dalgard that he felt strongly that it was simian fever, but he was reluctant to say so categorically. He wanted to play it carefully until the final tests were finished. Dalgard hung up the phone, believing that his decision to sacrifice the monkeys in room F had been correct. Those monkeys had been infected with simian fever and would have died anyway. What now worried Dalgard was the possibility that the virus had somehow escaped from Room F. It might be quietly working its way through the building, in which case monkeys might start dying in other rooms. And then the virus would be very hard to control. On Thanksgiving morning, Dan and his wife drove to Pittsburgh to be with Dan's wife's parents. They drove back to Virginia on Friday, and Dan headed over to the monkey house to see if there had been any changes. He was shocked by what he found. Over Thanksgiving, 5 monkeys had died in Room H, 2 doors down the hall from Room F. So the virus was moving, and what was worse, it was skipping rooms as it moved. How could it do that? 5 dead monkeys in 1 room during the night. He felt very uneasy. Medusa. November 27th, 0700 hours, Monday. Early on Monday morning of the week following Thanksgiving, Tom Geisbert went to work at the Institute wearing blue jeans, a flannel shirt, and cowboy boots as a kind of memento of his time in the woods. He was anxious to check up on the button of dead monkey cells that he had harvested from the little flask just before he had gone hunting. He wanted to look at the cells in his electron microscope to try to find some visual evidence that they were infected with simian fever. The button was a dot the size of a toast crumb, embedded in a tiny plug of yellow plastic. He unlocked a filing cabinet and removed his diamond knife. A diamond knife is a metal object no larger than a small pocket-sized pencil sharpener, about an inch long. It costs about $4,000. It has a diamond edge, a large, flawless, prism-shaped diamond, a gem-quality stone. He carried the diamond knife and the plug of plastic containing the toast crumb of cells into the cutting room. He sat down at a table, facing the cutting machine, and fitted his diamond knife into it, taking extreme care not to let his fingers touch the edge of the knife. One touch of a fingertip would destroy it. The diamond would also cut your fingertip, perhaps badly. The knife is extraordinarily sharp. It has the sharpest cutting edge of any tool on earth. It's sharp enough to split a virus cleanly in half, like a razor blade going through a peanut. If you consider the idea that 100 million viruses could cover the dot on this eye, then you get an idea of the sharpness of a diamond knife. If you happen to cut yourself with it, it would go through your skin without resistance, as if your skin were air. And it would split individual blood cells as it went through your finger. And then the knife edge would be covered with skin oil and blood cells and would be ruined. Tom looked into the eyepieces of a microscope that was attached to the cutting machine. Now he could see the toast crumb clearly. He threw a switch and the machine hummed, and the sample began to move back and forth, the toast crumb sliding across the edge of the diamond knife. The cutting machine worked like a deli slicer, peeling off slices about the size of a pencil dot. The slices fell onto a droplet of water and rested on the surface. Each contained as many as 10,000 cells, and the cells themselves were split by the knife. The blade peeled off slice after slice. They spread out like lily pads. He took his eyes away from the microscope and looked around the table until he found a wooden stick that had a human eyelash glued to it with a droplet of nail polish. It was a device for handling the slices. The eyelash had come from one of the women in the lab. It was generally believed that she had superior eyelashes for this kind of work, not too thick and not too thin, tapered, ending in fine points. He poked the eyelash into the water droplet and stirred it, separating the slices from one another. With the tip of the eyelash, he then lifted a few damaged slices out of the water and wiped them on a piece of tissue paper to get rid of them. Next, using a pair of tweezers, he picked up a small metal grid. The grid was about the size of a felt-tip pen dot, and it was made of copper. Holding the grid with his tweezers, he dipped it into the water and brought it up slowly underneath a floating slice, like a fisherman lifting up a dip net. The slice was now stuck to the grid. Still holding the grid with his tweezers, he put it into a tiny box. He carried the box down the hall to a darkened room. In the middle of the room stood a metal tower taller than a person. This was his electron microscope. My scope, he thought. He was very fond of it. He opened the tiny box, lifted out the grid with tweezers, and fitted it into a steel rod the size of a tire iron, the sample holder, as it was called. He slid the rod into the microscope until it clanked, locked in place. Now the slice, sitting on the grid, which was held in place by the tire iron, was positioned in the microscope, centered in the beam of electrons. He switched off the lights in the room and sat down at a console that was covered with dials and digital readouts. In the middle of the console, there was a viewing screen. The room had become the command deck of a starship, and the viewing screen was a window that looked down into the infinity within. He hit a switch, hunched down in his chair, and put his head close to the viewing screen. His face glowed greenish in the light of the screen and was reflected in the glass. Long hair, serious expression, deep-set eyes that scanned the terrain. He was looking into a corner of one cell. It was like looking at a landscape from high altitude. It was a cellscape. What loomed before his eyes was a huge, complicated vista, crowded with more detail than the mind could absorb. You could spend days scanning cells, looking for a virus. In one slice, there might be thousands of cells that needed to be searched, and you still might not find what you were looking for. The incredible thing about living systems is that no matter how small the view, it's just as complicated as ever. He could see forms and shapes that resembled rivers and streams and oxbow lakes, and he could see specks that might be towns, and he could see belts of forest. It was an aerial view of rainforest. The cell was a world down there, and somewhere in that jungle hid a virus. He turned a knob, and the cellscape drifted across his field of view, and he wandered through it. He zoomed in. The scene rushed up toward him. His breath stopped. Wait a minute. There was something wrong with this cell. This cell was a mess. It wasn't just dead. It had been destroyed. It was blown apart, and it was crawling with worms. The cell was wall to wall with worms. Some parts of the cell were so thick with virus, they looked like buckets of rope. There was only one kind of virus that looked like rope, a filovirus. He thought. Marburg. This stuff looks like Marburg. He hunched over the screen. His stomach screwed up into a knot and turned over, and he felt an unpleasant sensation. The puke factor. He almost panicked, almost ran out of the room shouting, Marburg! We've got Marburg! He thought, is this really happening? He sucked in his breath. He didn't know if this thing was Marburg, but it sure as hell looked like a filovirus, a thread virus. Then an image came into his mind. An image of Peter Cardinal's liver cells exploded and flooded with snakes. He brought the image into mental focus and compared it with what he saw on the screen. He knew exactly what the Cardinal strain looked like because he had memorized its curlicues and Cheerio shapes. What the virus did to that boy, the devastating effect on that boy's tissues. Oh, man, oh, man. Pete and I smelled this stuff. Pete and I have been handling this stuff, and this is a biosafety level 4 agent. Marburg, oh, man, A foul feeling washed over him, a sudden awareness of male reproductive glands hanging on the exterior of the body between the legs. Testicles the size of pears, black and putrid, the skin peeling off them. He began snapping photographs with his microscope. Several negatives came out of the machine. He carried them into a dark room and switched out the lights and began developing them. In pitch darkness, he had time to think. He counted the days back to the date of his exposure. Let's see. He had sniffed that flask on the Friday before he went hunting. That would have been 10 days ago. What's the incubation period for Marburg? He didn't know offhand. Let's see. Monkeys that inhaled Marburg virus took a long time to develop the disease, from 6 to 18 days. He was on day 10. I am in the window to be sick. I am in prime time to be dropping over. Did I have a headache yesterday? Do I have a headache now? Do I have a fever? He placed his hand on his forehead. Feels okay. Just because I don't get a headache on day 10 doesn't mean I won't get a headache on day 12. How deep did I breathe when I sniffed that flask? Did I snap the cap? That would spray stuff around. I can't remember. Did I rub my eye with my finger afterward? I can't remember. Did I touch my mouth with my finger? I might have. I don't know. He wondered if he'd made a mistake. Maybe this wasn't Marburg. He was only an intern. He was just learning this stuff. Finding major biosafety level 4 agents on the outskirts of Washington, D.C. is not the kind of thing interns do every day. Maybe this isn't a filovirus. How sure am I? If you go and tell your boss that you found Marburg and you're wrong, your career goes down the tubes. If you make a bad call, then first of all, you start a panic. Second, you become a laughingstock. He switched on the darkroom light and pulled the negatives out of the bath and held them up to the light. He saw virus particles shaped like snakes in negative images. They were white cobras tangled among themselves like the hair of Medusa. They were the face of nature herself, the obscene goddess revealed naked. This thing was breathtakingly beautiful. As he stared at it, he found himself being pulled out of the human world into a world where moral boundaries blur and finally dissolve completely. He was lost in wonder and admiration, even though he knew that he was the prey. Too bad he couldn't bring it down with a clean shot from a rifle. He saw something else in the pictures that left him frightened and filled with awe. The virus had altered the structure of the cell almost beyond recognition. It had transformed the cell into something that resembled a chocolate chip cookie that was mostly chocolate chips. The chips were crystal-like blocks of pure virus. He knew them as inclusion bodies. They were broods of virus getting ready to hatch. As the virus grows inside a cell, crystalloids or bricks appear at the center. Then they move outward toward the surface of the cell. When a brick touches the inner surface of the cell wall, it breaks apart into hundreds of individual viruses. The viruses are shaped like threads. The threads push through the cell wall and grow out of the cell like grass rising from seeded loam. As the bricks appear and move outward, they distort the cell, causing it to bulge and change shape, and finally the cell pops. It bursts and dies. The threads break away from the cell and drift into the bloodstream of the host, multiplying and taking over more cells and forming bricks and bursting the cells. As he looked at the bricks, he realized that what he had thought was pepper, when he had looked at the cells in the flask 10 days ago, those specks in the cells, were really inclusion bodies. That was also why the cells had looked swollen and fat. because they were pregnant and jammed with bricks of virus, because they were getting ready to burst. The First Angel. November 27th, 1000 hours, Monday. Tom Geisbert printed the negatives on 8x10 glossy paper and headed for the office of his boss, Peter Yarling. He carried his photograph down a long hallway, went downstairs and through a security door, swiping his ID card across a sensor, and entered a warren of rooms. He nodded to a soldier. There were soldiers everywhere, going about their business, and went up another flight of stairs and past a conference room that displayed a map of the world on the wall. In this room, army people discussed outbreaks of virus. A meeting was in progress in the room. Beyond it, he came to a cluster of offices. One of them was an awe-inspiring mess, papers everywhere. It belonged to Gene Johnson, the biohazard expert who had led the expedition to Katoom Cave. Across the way was Peter Yarling's office. It was neatly kept and small, but it had a window. Yarling had placed his desk under the window to get some extra light. On the walls he had hung drawings done by his children. There was a drawing by his daughter that showed a rabbit under a shining yellow sun. A shelf held an African sculpture of a human hand holding an egg on the tips of its fingers, as if the egg contained something interesting about to hatch. "What's up, Tom?" Yarling asked. "We have a big problem here." Geisbert placed the photographs in a row on Yarling's desk. It was a gray November day, and the light from the window fell gently on the images of Medusa. "This came from the Reston monkeys," Geisbert said. "I think it's a filovirus, and there may be a good chance it's Marburg." Yarling remembered sniffing the flask and said, "You're playing a joke on me. This isn't funny." "This is no joke, Pete." "Are you sure?" Yarling asked. Geisbert said he felt very sure. Yarling looked carefully at the photographs. Yes, he could see worms. Yes, he and Geisbert might have breathed it into their lungs. Well, they didn't have headaches yet. He remembered remarking to the pathologist as he cut up the little pink chunk of mystery meat in the tin foil, "Good thing this ain't Marburg." "Yeah, right." "Is this stuff the right size?" Yarling asked. He got a ruler and measured the particles. "It looks a little long to be Marburg," Geisbert said. "Marburg particles form loops like Cheerios. This stuff was more like spaghetti." They opened a textbook and compared Geisbert's pictures with the textbook pictures. "It looks good to me," Yarling said. "I'm going to show it to C.J. Peters." Yarling, a civilian, had decided to notify the military chain of command. It started with Colonel Clarence James Peters, M.D. He was the chief of the Disease Assessment Division at the Institute, the doctor who dealt with the dangerous unknowns. The interesting stuff, as he called it. Peters had built up this division almost single-handedly, and he ran it single-handedly. He was a strange sort of military man, easygoing and casually brilliant. He had wire-rimmed glasses, a round, ruddy, pleasant face with a mustache, a light Texas drawl. He wasn't a large man, but he liked to eat, and he believed himself to be overweight. He spoke fluent Spanish, which he had learned during his years in the jungles of Central and South America, hunting for hot agents. He was required by army regulations to show up for work at 8 o'clock in the morning, but he usually drifted in around 10 o'clock. He disliked wearing a uniform. Usually, he wore faded blue jeans with a flaming Hawaiian shirt, along with sandals and dweebish white socks, looking like he had just spent the night in a Mexican hotel. His excuse for his lack of uniform was that he suffered from athlete's foot, an incurable tropical strain that he had picked up in Central America, and could never quite get rid of, and so he had to wear socks with sandals in order to keep air circulating around his toes. And the jeans and the flaming shirt were part of the package. Peters worked 12-hour days and left work at night, often long after everyone else had gone home. C.J. Peters could swim through a bureaucracy like a shark. He inspired great loyalty in his staff, and he made enemies easily and deliberately when it suited him. He drove a red Toyota that had seen better days. On his travels in rainforests and tropical savannas, he ate with pleasure whatever the locals were eating. He had consumed frogs, snakes, zebra meat, jellyfish, lizards, and toads cooked whole in their skin. But he thought he had never eaten salamanders, at least none that he had been able to identify in a soup. He had eaten boiled monkey thigh, and he had drunk banana beer fermented with human saliva. In Central Africa, while leading an expedition in search of Ebola virus, he'd found himself in termite country during swarming season, and he had waited by termite nests and collected the termites as they swarmed out and had eaten them raw. He thought they had a nice sort of nutty taste. He liked termites so much that he refrigerated them with his blood samples to keep the termites fresh all day so that he could snack on them like peanuts with his evening gin as the sun went down over the African plains. He was fond of suffocated guinea pig baked in its own blood and viscera. The guinea pig is split open like a book, offering treasures, and he enjoyed picking out and eating the guinea pig's lungs, adrenal glands, and brain. And then, inevitably, he would pay a price. "I always get sick, but it's worth it," he once said to me. He was a great believer in maps, and his offices always contained many maps hung on the walls, showing locations of outbreaks of virus. Yarling put Gysbert's photographs in a folder. He didn't want anyone to see them. He found Peters at a meeting in the conference room that held the map of the world. Yarling tapped him on the shoulder. "I don't know what you're doing right now, CJ, but I've got something more important." "What is it?" Yarling held the folder closed. "It's a little sensitive. I really don't want to flash it here." "What's so sensitive?" Yarling opened the folder slightly, just enough to give CJ a glimpse of spaghetti, and snapped it shut. The colonel's face took on a look of surprise. He stood up, and without a word to the others, without even excusing himself, he walked out of the room with Yarling. They went back to Yarling's office and closed the door behind them. Gysbert was there, waiting for them. Yarling spread the photographs on his desk. "Take a look at these, CJ." The colonel flipped through the photographs. "What's this from, anyway?" he asked. "It's from those monkeys in Reston. It doesn't look good to me. Tom thinks it's Marburg." "We've been fooled before," CJ said. "A lot of things look like worms." He stared at the photographs. The worms were unmistakable. And there were the crystalloids, the bricks. It looked real. It felt real. He experienced what he would later describe as a major pucker factor setting in. He thought, "This is going to be an awful problem for that town in Virginia and those people there." "The first question," he went on, "is what are the chances of laboratory contamination?" The stuff could be the Army's own cardinal strain. It might have somehow leaked out of a freezer and gotten into those flasks. But that seemed impossible, and the more they pondered it, the more impossible it seemed. The cardinal strain was kept in a different area of the building, behind several walls of biocontainment, a long distance from the monkey flasks. There were multiple safeguards to prevent the accidental release of a virus like Marburg cardinal. That just wasn't possible. It couldn't be a contamination, but it might be something other than a virus. It might be a false alarm. "People around here see something long and stringy, and they think they've got a filovirus," C.J. Peters said. "I'm skeptical. A lot of things look like Marburg. I agree, Yarling replied. It could be nothing. It could be just another Loch Ness monster. What are you doing to confirm it? The colonel asked him. Yarling explained that he was planning to test the cells with human blood samples that would make them glow if they were infected with Marburg. Okay, you're testing for Marburg, CJ said. Are you going to include a test for Ebola? Sure, I already thought of that. When will your tests be done? Because if those monkeys have Marburg, we have to figure out what to do. Dan Dalgard, for example, was a prime candidate for coming down with Marburg because he had dissected that monkey. I'll have a definite yes or no on Marburg by tomorrow, Yarling said. C.J. Peters turned to Tom Geisbert and said that he wanted more proof. He wanted pictures of the agent actually growing in monkey liver from a monkey that had died in the monkey house. That would prove that it lived in the monkeys. CJ could see that a military and political crisis was brewing. If the public found out what Marburg does, there could be panic. He stood up with a photograph of snakes in his hand and said, "If we are going to announce that Marburg has broken out near Washington, we had better be damn sure we're right." Then he dropped the photograph on Yarling's desk and returned to his meeting under the map of the world. After C.J. Peters left Yarling's office, a delicate conversation occurred between Peter Yarling and Tom Geisbert. They shut the door and talked quietly about the whiffing incident. It was something they had better get straight between them. Neither of them had mentioned to Colonel C.J. Peters that they had whiffed that flask. They counted the days back to their exposure. 10 days had passed since they had uncapped the flask and whiffed what could be Eau de Marburg. Tomorrow would be day 11. The clock was ticking. They were in the incubation period. What were they going to do? What about their families? They wondered what Colonel Peters would do if he found out what they'd done. He might order them into the Slammer, the level 4 biocontainment hospital. They could end up in the Slammer behind airlocks and double steel doors, tended by nurses and doctors wearing spacesuits. A month in the Slammer, while the doctors hovered over you in spacesuits, drawing samples of your blood, just waiting for you to crash. The doors of the Slammer are kept locked, the air is kept under negative pressure, and your telephone calls are monitored, because people have emotional breakdowns in the Slammer and try to escape. They start flaking out by the second week. They become clinically depressed, non-communicative. They stare at the walls, speechless, passive, won't even watch television. Some of them become agitated and fearful. Some of them need to have a continual drip of Valium in the arm to keep them from pounding on the walls, smashing the viewing windows, tearing up the medical equipment. They sit on death row in solitary confinement, waiting for the spiking fevers, horrible pain in the internal organs, brain strokes, and finally the end game with its sudden, surprising, uncontrollable gushes of blood. Most of them claim loudly that they haven't been exposed to anything. They deny that anything could go wrong with them, and ordinarily nothing does go wrong with them physically in the Slammer, and they come out healthy. Their minds are another story. In the Slammer, they become paranoid, convinced that the army bureaucracy has forgotten about them, has left them to rot. When they come out, they are disoriented. They emerge through the airlock door, pale, shaken, tentative, trembling, angry with the army, angry with themselves. The nurses, trying to cheer them up, give them a cake studded with the number of candles equal to the number of days they've been living in the Slammer. They blink in confusion and terror at a mass of flaming candles on their Slammer cake, perhaps more candles than they've ever seen on one of their own birthday cakes. One guy was locked in the Slammer for 42 days, 42 candles on his Slammer cake. Many people who've been isolated in the slammer choose to cut down on their work in level 4, begin to find all kinds of excuses for why they really can't put on a spacesuit today, or tomorrow, or the day after that. Many of the people who have been in the slammer end up quitting their jobs and leaving the Institute altogether. Peter Yarling felt that, on the whole, he was not at much risk of contracting the virus, nor was Tom. If he did contract it, he would know soon enough. His blood would test positive, or he would get a headache that wouldn't go away. In any case, he believed very strongly that Marburg wasn't easy to catch, and he didn't think there was any danger to his family or to anyone else around town. But think about Dan Dalgard cutting into the monkeys, bending over and breathing monkey when he opened their abdomens. He was bending over their intestines, over a pool of Marburg blood. So then why isn't Dalgard dead? Well, he reasoned, nothing's happened to him, so maybe nothing will happen to us. Where had it come from? Was it a new strain? What was it capable of doing to humans? The discoverer of a new strain of virus gets to name it. Yarling thought about that, too. If he and Tom were locked up in the slammer, they wouldn't be able to carry out any research on this virus. They were on the verge of a major discovery, and the glory of it perhaps tantalized them. To find a filovirus near Washington was the discovery of a lifetime. For all these reasons, they decided to keep their mouths shut. They decided to test their blood for the virus. Yarling said something to Gysbert like, "We're going to get blood samples drawn from ourselves, like right now." If their blood went positive, they could immediately report to the slammer. If their blood remained negative, and they didn't develop other symptoms, then there was little chance they could infect anyone else. Obviously, they didn't want to go to the regular clinic to have an army nurse take their blood. So they found a friendly civilian technician, and he twisted a rubber band around their arms, and they watched while he filled some tubes with their blood. He understood what had happened, and he said he would keep his mouth shut. Yarling then put on a spacesuit and carried his own blood into his level 4 hot lab. He also took with him Gysbert's blood and the flasks of milky stuff. It was very strange, handling your own blood while wearing a spacesuit. It seemed, however, quite risky to let his blood lie around where someone might be accidentally exposed to it. His blood had to be biocontained in a hot zone. If it was infected with Marburg, he didn't want to be responsible for it killing anyone. He said to himself, "Given that this was a piece of mystery meat sniffed out of a monkey carcass, I should have been a little more careful." Tom Gysbert went off to collect some pickled monkey liver that he could photograph for viruses, hoping to prove that the Marburg-like agent lived in the monkeys. He found a plastic jug that contained sterilized pieces of liver from monkey 053. He fished some liver out of the jug, clipped a few bits off it, and fixed the bits in plastic. This was a slow job and took many hours to finish. He left the plastic to cure overnight, and went home for a couple of hours to try to get some sleep. The Second Angel. November 28th, Tuesday. Tom Gysbert lived in a small town in West Virginia, across the Potomac River. After his separation from his wife, his two children had stayed with her for a time, and now they were staying with him, or rather, they were staying with his parents in their house down the road. Both his children were toddlers. He got up at 4 o'clock in the morning, drank a cup of coffee, and skipped breakfast. He drove his Bronco in pitch darkness across the Potomac River and through Antietam National Battlefield, a broad ridge of cornfields and farmlands scattered with stone monuments to the dead. He passed through the front gate of Fort Detrick, parked, and went past the security desk and into his microscope area. The dawn came gray, gusty, and warm. As light, the color of old aluminum, glimmered around the institute. Tom sliced pieces of monkey liver with his diamond knife and put them into the electron microscope. A few minutes later, he took a photograph of virus particles budding directly out of cells in the liver of monkey 053. The animal's liver was full of snakes. These photographs were definite proof that the virus was multiplying in the Reston monkeys, that it was not a laboratory contamination. He also found inclusion bodies inside the monkey's liver cells. The animal's liver was being transformed into crystal bricks. He carried his new photographs to Peter Yarling's office. Then they both went to see Colonel C.J. Peters. The colonel stared at the photographs. Okay. He was convinced, too. The agent was growing in those monkeys. Now they would have to wait for Yarling's test results, because that would be the final confirmation that it was indeed Marburg. Yarling wanted to nail down this Marburg as fast as he could. He spent most of the day in a spacesuit, working in his hot lab, putting together his tests. In the middle of the day, he decided that he had to call Dan Dalgard. He couldn't wait any longer, even without test results. He wanted to warn Dalgard of the danger, yet he wanted to deliver the warning carefully, so as not to cause a panic in the monkey house. "You definitely have SHF in the monkey house," he said. "We have definitely confirmed that. However, there is also the possibility of a second agent in at least some of the animals." "What agent? Can you tell me what agent?" Dalgard asked. "I don't want to identify the agent right now," Yarling said, "because I don't want to start a panic. But there are serious potential public health hazards associated with it, if, in fact, we are dealing with this particular agent." Somehow, the way Yarling used the words panic and particular made Dalgard think of Marburg virus. Everyone who handled monkeys knew about Marburg. It was a virus that could easily make people panic. "Is it Marburg or some similar agent?" Dalgard asked. "Yes, something like that," Yarling said. "We'll have confirmation later in the day. I'm working on the tests now. I feel it's unlikely the results will be positive for this second agent. But you should take precautions not to do any necropsies on any animals until we've completed the tests. Look, I don't want to set off too many whistles and bells, but I don't want you and your employees walking into that room unnecessarily. How soon can you get back to me with a definite yes or no about this second agent? We need to know as soon as possible." "I'll call you back today, I promise," Yarling said. Dalgard hung up the phone, highly disturbed, but he maintained his usual calm manner. A second agent, and it sounded as if it was Marburg. The people who had died in Germany, he knew, had been handling raw, bloody monkey meat. The meat was full of virus, and they got it on their hands, or they rubbed it on their eyelids. He and other people at the company had been cutting into sick monkeys since October, and yet no one had become sick. Everyone had worn rubber gloves. He wasn't afraid for himself. He felt fine. But he began to worry about the others. He thought, even if the virus is Marburg, the situation is still no different from before. We're still stuck in a pot. The question is how to get ourselves out of this pot. He called Bill Volt and ordered him not to cut into any more monkeys. Then he sat in his office, getting more and more annoyed as the day darkened, and Peter Yarling didn't call him back. He wondered if any of the men had cut themselves with a scalpel while performing a dissection of a diseased monkey. Chances were they wouldn't file an accident report. He knew for sure that he hadn't cut himself. But he had performed a mass sacrifice of approximately 50 animals. He'd been in contact with 50 animals. How long had it been since then? He should be showing some symptoms by now. Bloody nose, fever, something like that. At 5:30, he called Yarling's office and got a soldier on the phone who answered by saying, "How can I help you, sir or ma'am?" "I'm sorry, sir, Dr. Yarling is not in his office." "No, sir, I don't know where he is, sir." "No, he has not left work. May I take a message, sir?" Dalgard left a message for Yarling to call him at home. He was feeling steadily more annoyed. 1500 hours. Yarling was in his spacesuit. He worked steadily all afternoon in his own lab, Hot Zone AA4, at the center of the building, where he fiddled with the flasks of virus culture from the monkey house. It was a slow, irritating job. His tests involved making the samples glow under ultraviolet light. If he could make the samples glow, then he knew he had the virus. In order to do this, he needed to use blood serum from human victims. The blood serum would react to viruses. He went to the freezers and got out vials of frozen blood serum from three people. Two of the people had died, one had survived. They were 1. Busoke. A test for Marburg. Serum from the blood of Dr. Shem Busoke, a survivor. Presumably reactive against the Kitum Cave strain, which had started with Charles Monet and jumped into Dr. Musoke's eyes in the black vomit. 2. Boniface. A test for Ebola Sudan, from a man named Boniface who died in Sudan. 3. Mayinga. A test for Ebola Zaire. Nurse Mayinga's blood serum. The test was delicate and took hours to complete. It was not made easier by the fact that he was shuffling around in his spacesuit the whole time. First, he put droplets of cells from the monkey culture onto glass slides and let them dry and treated them with chemicals. Then he put drops of the blood serum on the slides. They would glow in the presence of the target virus. Now it was time to look. This had to be done in total darkness because the glow would be faint. He shuffled over to a storage closet, went inside it, and closed the door behind him. A microscope sat on a table in the closet, and there was a chair, and from the wall hung an air hose. He plugged the hose into his spacesuit and put the slides into the microscope. Then he turned out the lights. He felt around in the darkness for the chair and sat down. This was not a fun place to be if you happened to have a touch of claustrophobia, sitting in a pitch-black level 4 closet while wearing a spacesuit. Peter Yarling had made his peace with suffocation and darkness a long time ago. He waited for a minute to give his eyes time to adapt to the dark, and the little sparkles of light in his eyes, as they adjusted to the darkness, eventually faded away, while cool, dry air roared around his face and whiffled the hair on his forehead. Then he looked through the binocular eyepieces of the microscope. He wore his eyeglasses inside his spacesuit, and that made it particularly difficult to see. He pressed the faceplate against his nose and squinted. He moved his face from side to side. His nose left a greasy streak inside his faceplate. He twisted his helmet until it was turned nearly sideways. Finally, he saw through the eyepieces. Two circles drifted into his sight, and he focused his eyes, bringing the circles together. He was looking down into vast terrain. He saw cells dimly outlined in a faint glow. It was like flying over a country at night, over thinly populated lands. It was normal to see a faint glow. He was looking for a bright glow. He was looking for a city. He scanned the slides with his eyes, back and forth, moving across the microscopic world, looking for a telltale greenish glow. The Musoke did not glow. The Boniface glowed weakly. To his horror, the Mayinga glowed brightly. He jerked his head back. Ah, no! He adjusted his helmet and looked again. The Mayinga blood serum was still glowing. The dead woman's blood was reacting to the virus in the monkey house. He got an ugly feeling in the pit of his stomach. Those monkeys didn't have Marburg. They had Ebola. Those animals were dying of Ebola Zaire. His stomach lurched and turned over, and he sat frozen in the dark closet, with only the sound of his air and the thud of his heart. Chain of Command, 1600 hours, Tuesday. This can't be Ebola Zaire, Peter Yarling thought. Somebody must have switched the samples by accident. He looked again. Yeah, the Mayinga blood serum was definitely glowing. It meant he and Tom could be infected with Ebola Zaire, which kills 9 out of 10 victims. He decided that he'd made a mistake in his experiment. He must have accidentally switched around his samples or gotten something mixed up. He decided to do the test again. He turned on the lights in the closet and shuffled out into his lab, this time keeping careful track of his vials, bottles, and slides to make sure that nothing got mixed up. Then he carried the new samples back into the closet and turned out the lights and looked again into his microscope. Once again, the Mayinga blood glowed. So maybe it really was Ebola Zaire or something closely related to it. The dead woman's blood knew this virus and reacted to it. Good thing this ain't Marburg. Well, guess what? It ain't Marburg. This is the honker from Zaire, or maybe its twin sister. Ebola had never been seen outside Africa. What was it doing near Washington? How in the hell had it gotten here? What would it do? He thought, I'm onto something really hot. He was wearing his spacesuit, but he didn't want to take the time to decon out through the airlock. There was an emergency telephone on the wall in his lab. He disconnected his air hose to extinguish the roar of air so that he could hear through the receiver, and he punched C.J. Peters' phone number. C.J., he shouted through his helmet, it's Pete Yarling. It's real, and it's Ebola. Nah, C.J. replied. Yeah, Ebola. It's got to be a contamination, C.J. said. No, it isn't a contamination. Could you have gotten your samples mixed up? Yeah, I know. My first thought was that somebody had switched the samples, but they weren't switched, CJ, because I did the test twice. Twice? Ebola Zaire both times. I've got the results right here. I can pass them to you. Take a look for yourself. I'm coming down there, CJ said. He hung up the phone and hurried downstairs to Yarling's hot lab. Yarling, meanwhile, picked up a sheet of waterproof paper on which he had written down the results of his tests. He slid the paper into a tank full of EnviroChem. The tank went through the wall to a level zero corridor outside the hot zone. The tank worked on the same principle as a sliding cash drawer in a teller's window. You could pass an object from the hot zone through the tank into the normal world. It would be disinfected on its way through the tank. CJ stood at a thick glass window on the other side, looking in at Yarling. They waited for several minutes while the chemicals penetrated the paper and sterilized it. Then CJ opened the tank from his side and removed the paper, dripping with chemicals, and held it in his hands. He motioned to Yarling through the window. Go back to the phone. Yarling shuffled back to the emergency telephone and waited for it to ring. It rang, and there was CJ's voice on the line. Get out of there, and let's go see the commander. It was time to move this thing up the chain of command. Yarling deconned out through the airlock, got dressed in his street clothes, and hurried to CJ Peters' office. And they both went to the office of the commander of USAMRID, a colonel named David Huxall. They brushed past his secretary, told her it was an emergency, and sat down at a conference table in his office. "Guess what?" CJ said. "It looks like we found a filovirus in a bunch of monkeys outside Washington. We've recovered what we think is